we start the castle in the forest.
Yep. There's a footnote down there that I just think is kind of captures some stuff we've been saying, that 16, every attentive person knows their hell.
Right.
But not all know their devil. There are not only joyful devils, but also sad ones.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. I wanted to point that out, too. Well, you get this idea of how joy and the devil are linked. More joy and the disappointments and complications it leads to, which are trouble on one hand, and on the other, lead to the wholeness, if you can withdraw the projections you have made into the situation, and you don't get a chance to withdraw the projection until you've made it. Often you need that experience for the situation that you'll project on. So this is what he's trying to get straight. Now this next one's heavy again. I'm trying to think what we can...
Do we have an image with the
camera? Oh, yes. You want to think about that a little bit?
A lot of reflecting going on, that's for sure. And there's three towers, so that means the fourth is coming.
Yep. Good. Keep going. You guys do a good job on this stuff. A light in there. There's a human light and a moon light.
Mm-hmm. It's only a half moon, so it's not complete.
Who's up on their moons? Is that waxing or waning?
Waxing.
Waxing.
The D is very different than the D in the picture just before, with the tower picture. I'm sorry, that's a fancy one.
Oh, yeah.
Very different. Now he's making that transition into this, how did he term it, the real world,
mm-hmm.
symbolism.
Yeah. Well, it's connected to land. It's in the middle of the water, but it's connected to land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a bridge.
Bridge.
There's a bridge. Where is this bridge? I was just gonna say a
quiet dark swamp.
That, okay, that's how did you get bridge it?
Now did he mention a bridge in the text?
Well, not that I remember.
No. I think he goes through a swamp to get there.
Right. Right. It would be part of the shadow of the I just do.
Comes to a swamp.
It looks like a figure to me.
Looks like
a figure
of
a person.
Look on the.
What
would
you think it was?
It looks like the figure of a person. It's hard to see because of the sunlight reflecting in here, but it's shaped like
the face of a person.
No, well, a body of a person.
Does this thing work?
Let's try it. Well, if you look on the picture, Sandy has, you can really see it, that it looks like a person.
You know how tiny this image is that he's...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right, because there's
painting.
A space here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's him.
I don't know. He's made everything else to scale. This person
would
be
right.
50 feet tall.
Right, right.
Right.
But, I don't know. Yeah, because
it's the same color as the shadow down below, but...
What's it a shadow of then? Because it's considerably darker than the surrounding rock. And the golden area in the front of this castle to me looks like the shape of an individual, and that could be purely a random thing. But to me, it's like you get the light man and the dark man coming in the side door or the back door there. Just purely imagination on my part. Now let's see. In
there, I thought that was when I was showing the light figure. I didn't connect that dark figure with it.
In the text, this at image is about this big. So you can imagine how difficult all those, how small that actually is.
That one. You know, he didn't take as much care with this image as he has with this other image.
Good point.
It's just kind of, it's more slapped on there than his other images, in my opinion.
What I noticed more than what was in the picture was, after reading it, what was not the picture, because so much about the ghostly girl, what we'll be reading about in a minute. But she's not really in the picture unless that's her in the doorway. But in all of, when he was doing the Elijah and Salome pictures, there were real pictures. That, and then he kind of mysteriously doesn't, I mean, that's the only picture of this whole section.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not so much in images about her. Almost as if she is not able to be what her image is. Of course, I feel like that much.
It's also called Castle in the Forest. I mean, where's the forest? That's
well,
the front area?
Yeah,
is that
it's
all? Those could, okay. And he also talks about the swamp, but we don't really don't get the feeling of the swamp.
Yeah, and you wouldn't find a swamp in that context, would you?
Mm-hmm. Well,
you have swampy areas like in a rainforest.
Yeah, I was just thinking we were in this delta, and there was water, a waterway, and then on either side, there were rushes that looked, they were very tall. They were.
I mean, you can get a boggy area in high country in mountains like that. It's not so much what we think of as a swamp, but it's very wet and you can sink in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not land. It's really, you couldn't walk on it. Yeah.
Right. I like how we're not too far off in the day to the time of year. This was December 28, 1913, and here we are close to December.
Wow.
Yeah. Oof.
It's hard to imagine it was almost 100 years.
It doesn't feel that old. Do you feel?
No.
No.
Especially later where he's talking about the attitude men and women should have to one another.
Yeah.
That was so spot on to now.
Yeah, we think of just this last century as a time of such an incredible change. There's been an incredible change in the outer world, but I don't know what's going
to be.
So on the second night thereafter, I am walking alone in a dark forest, and I notice that I have lost my way. They footnote a reference to Dante. That should be obvious, I think. Some of this maybe we can summarize for the sake of time. He goes through a swamp to a castle. Door is opened. He asks for lodgings for the night. And he comes upon a scholar. I scanned swiftly. It's a scholar study with bookshelves on all four walls and a large writing desk. That's the second paragraph. He goes on more descriptions. He greets me embarrassed, as if absent and defensive. Maybe we'll pick up. After a longer pause, here I am, first, second, third paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
After a longer pause, the old man remarks, "So you want to sleep, then please yourself." I notice that he is absent-minded and therefore ask him to instruct the servant to show me a chamber. To this he says, "You are demanding. Wait, I cannot just drop everything." He sinks again into his book. I wait patiently. After a while, he looks up astonished. "What do you want here? Oh, forgive me. I totally forgot that you are waiting here. I'll call the servant straight away." The servant comes and leads me to a small chamber on the same floor, etc., etc. I'm tired. I undress. My errant ways have led me to a strange place. No one else seems to be living in the house. To four lines down, the old man has hidden his beautiful daughter here. Again, little reference to Salome and Elijah. We might just stop there real quick. What's going on, do you think? First of all, can you think of the parallel to this scene? The scholar? Faust? Remember, Faust is in his study? And Mephistopheles, the devil, appears as a poodle. I think just on the most banal level, Jung is in danger of being a boring old scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Just to put it very prosaically. Nietzsche wasn't boring, but he was certainly identified with his intellect at a great price. Yeah. I think that's the most prosaic level. Have you all heard my little spiel about Faust? Some of you heard it, huh? Let me just repeat it real quick. Because Jung felt answering the problem of Faust was the meaning of his life. That's why I mentioned it. Because he carved over this his mulligan doorway, Faust's penitence, Philemon shrine. I'll explain that real quick here. Faust is a bored scholar. The devil comes and says, "Let's make a deal. I'll solve your boredom problem. And if I do, you have to give me your soul." And Faust says, okay. Of course, the first thing Faust wants is a tasty young girl. So, Mephistopheles, the devil, gets in the tasty young girl, and they have an affair, and she goes insane, and her brother commits suicide. See? Destructive passion. Faust Part 2 was written at the end of Goethe's life, Part 1 at the beginning. And it's the same idea. Faust and Mephistopheles are out. And everything Faust has touched has turned to nothing or destruction. So that would be the destructive aspect of morality. Faust is this very high scholar. So Faust decides, I better make good on all this harm I've done, so I'm going to help recover land from the sea and build dwellings. This is about the time I think Amsterdam was being recovered. I think Amsterdam, a lot of Amsterdam is built on sea land that had been turned into to habitable land. And in the process, he kills an old couple living on the beach. So once again, his good intent leads to destruction. And the old couple is Philemon and Baucis. That's a reference to Greek myth, where the two were an old couple living in the woods. Zeus and Hermes stopped in for a night stay unannounced. They weren't announcing themselves as gods, but as travelers. And the old couple received them and gave them a night's stay. And as a result of their hospitality, the gods granted them immortality. Make a long story short. There's more to it, but make it short. See, that's what Faust kills. So again, the intellect, the Western scientific intellect, if you put it on the big scale, or if you put it on the small scale, Jung's own intellectual nature has very destructive consequences. And what Jung felt his job was to change the way the mind works so it doesn't kill things. So his work was an attempt to solve this problem. And he felt Faust, as the scholar, represented that the power drive of the intellect that says where there's a will, there's a way. And then that always is destructive. What Jung tried to develop was a way of living where we find the way and the will follows. How do you get to the way? By following your passion and seeing what images it generates. Does that make sense? So it's a really important image here, this scholar. You see, he hides the girl. So he is out of touch with and represses the feminine. So he's that nitpicking Western mind. It simply cannot come to grips with the soul. So what Jung will try to do is, how can we develop our minds so it serves the soul and not kills it? You know, read any academic book, and it's soul murder. Rational, nitpicky, logical, dry. So I think we can take this on two levels. Jung is meeting his own tendency to be a boring old guy. On one hand, and on the other hand, he's confronting the Western power drive. I don't know if you saw the movie Paris, anyone? Not Paris, Je T'aime. It's just called Paris, with your friend Fabrice. Yeah. Not friend, but...
I wish you were my friend.
She wishes you were friend. Well, it's a story. It starts with this guy. It's a lighthearted movie. Well, not so lighthearted, but it's a very pleasant movie called Paris. And came out within a year, I think. But it's about this professor who falls in love with a young student. And it starts out, I just thought it was so wonderful the way it illustrated. It starts out with this professor in the school, and this guy comes up to him and goes on and on and on about some picayune detail of a Roman coin, and that proves that a certain legion was not at this spot at a certain point in history, it was actually at this spot, and on and on. The guy just looks at him, and then he goes to talk to his brother. He says, I'm afraid I'm turning into that. These people, they just nitpick, and I forget how he put it very well, but and humorously. I don't want to end up like that, getting so excited about some coin's message for where a certain troop was at a certain date. Who cares? But this is what academia has turned into. And then he, of course, falls in love with this girl, and everything changes, but same kind of idea. So that's the scholar.
Jerry, could there be a reference to I'm still thinking Grail, the Grail Castle in the forest, and the wrong relationship with the feminine?
Well, in that sense, the scholar would be the Grail King.
Yeah.
And he's definitely wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think in the Grail, I thought it was more his split was between good and evil.
Okay.
Here, it's mind and instinct. But, you know, the content of the split may change, but the basic idea could stay the same.
It also reminds me of the poem The Raven, which would have been written around...
Is that Poe, you mean?
Yeah, and it would have been written around the same time or a little later, actually, but it's that same thing, you know, that there's something knocking at my inner door, and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And there's also something I've hidden that I want to really talk about, which is making me more terrified.
So what's knocking here is this girl. Again, Elijah and Salome. So what we've learned applies.
And Denizer, just
at
one page after he has said, one must take every unknown wanderer in the unconscious seriously.
Yeah,
right. But he eventually accepts her.
But he does accept her.
Give the guy a break. These are very upsetting discoveries. Am I seeing straight? A slim girl, pale as death, standing at the door. For heaven's sakes, what's this? She's coming here.
And she's been waiting for him. Have you come at last?
And she's been waiting. Oh, this is another part worth talking about. Two paragraphs, if you count the last line, a paragraph, two paragraphs up, she says, oh, you think me common.
Going back just a second to what Carol was saying, he's just seeming to take the red one more seriously, even though he's just afraid of him as the devil. He seems more put off by the fact that this girl is not what he was expecting at the next thing.
Yeah, but suppose she's the devil.
But at least the devil was grand. I think that's part of what.
But was grand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of his disappointment in this figure. It's like, well, you're nothing but a cheap dinosaur novel.
Right.
Well, she's just what a scholar would have contempt for.
Yeah, so let's look at that. Oh, you think me common. How does that play in here?
Well, later in the page, she comments on the great value of the commonplace.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. That she's the soul again. What's the soul? Well, you may want to try it?
Yikes.
What's he fighting for here?
His relation to life.
Yeah, it's hard to describe it. Let's try it, his relationship to life. Of course, it's an emotional state. It's feeling alive. It's having something to give. It's warmth. It's ability to make contact. The ability to be emotionally inspired and to be emotionally inspiring.
That feels like it's been right there. Be inspired and inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Emotionally, it feels like that's the wall he's sort of hitting.
Yeah.
That he's gone through all this thing with the devil talking about joy and joy as it would mean to have Tony Wolf, which I am sure he was. Well, he says, I haven't yet found this joy. So, evidently, he hadn't at least acknowledged to himself or to his devil that she was. I mean, this is 1913. She was there. Wasn't
yeah.
She? So.
I think you've hit it, Sandy, that he's just coming to grips.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my joy. Mm-hmm. Now.
It seems like he also, you know, he's really been looking at Tony as an object of sexual pleasure, and who he also
finds entertaining to talk with, but he hasn't ever really tapped into his own feminine side in what we're reading here. And it seems to me like this is saying, you know, buddy, you don't just get to play. You actually have to deal with the feminine here, too. And now you've got three chances because you've got Emma, Antoni, and your psyche.
I don't think he ever saw her as an object. Problematic was the sexual aspect of the relationship. I mean, they were friends. So it's how far do I take this?
But it seems like when he's talking about joy, he's thinking sexually. He's not thinking, wow, I can really deepen this friendship and have something long.
I think he is both.
Okay.
Both. In other words, do I totally give myself to this relationship?
Okay.
I mean, in the next paragraph, she's sobbing, and he thinks, my God, in the end, she really is real. And isn't that the thing we wrestle with all the time? We say that the things that we feel from the psyche here are somehow less than, less real
yeah.
than this outer world. And he's coming to grips with the fact that, you know, she really is real to me. And I have done her injustice. I just realize that.
I take it on both levels. He's realizing, oh my God, this experience is the foundation of reality, like you're saying. And there's a real person out there. And I have to do it on both levels.
Thinking the difference between spirit and soul. I think of spirit as very religious, very...
Not as Jung uses it.
Not earthbound part of spirituality. Heaven as something out there that's far away. Whereas soul, you think of, at least for me, as more. It's more common, but it's the everyday of the things that you...
Let me give you Jung's definition of spirit. Some of these people have heard it 50 times, but let me give it. Because he does use it in a particular way. A factor which creates images in the inner field of vision and arranges them in a meaningful order. So it's what's behind the fact that our dreams evolve. Now, as far as the heavens go, he would say, then that is projected onto the heavens, but it is really an internal an internal dynamism. But you're right, it is not immediately obvious how it's connected with the earth.
I guess I'm still saying that part of it is very out there.
That's
more abstract.
It's more abstract. Yeah.
It's more distant. It's not something that. Mm-hmm. And this next image comes to him as something common,
yeah.
something everyday.
And that's more the soul.
And that is more the soul. I think that he was surprised. It seems surprising to him when it comes, and shocking and upsetting. But then he sees it as, wait, this really is. This makes it real, and then it's more important, actually, than the spiritual stuff that we might have valued more highly. Yeah.
What he's eventually going to come to see is, and the spirit works through that real. Yeah.
They're not separate.
Right. And or they, in the best of all possible words, worlds, they work together.
I think that we're also conditioned, you know, he's expecting, okay, I've come to this point, now there should be something great, like literature, and I'm getting Pulp Fiction, and, you know, it's really hard to admit that some Pulp Fiction is more meaningful than some, you know, there are many times that I would rather read a beach novel than something that's really
more in peace.
Well, you know, like all of Oprah's books, I call it the Slit Your Wrist Club, because by the time you finish reading them, you just wish you were dead. And that's not good reading to me.
Why is that?
What kind of books are they?
Oprah's Book Club? Basically, you know, some horrible aspect of the human condition with no humor ever.
The person has prevailed through that or something?
Yes, how they survived such deep trauma for pages and pages. And if you make it through, I mean, you really deserve an award. I would much rather read about somebody who, you know, they kept the whole experience. It's not just done to them, done to them, and then they come through and somehow they're Oprah. I mean, that's what it feels like when you read the book. That's why I call it the Split Your Wrist Club.
What's your name?
I wonder if the thought came to me, because he is upset about this dying novel situation.
Right.
But on the page before, he's talking to the devil, and he's talking to the red man, or whatever you want to call him, and he's getting all hot about this joy.
Yeah.
It's really this experience is going to come here for me, and it may be this woman out here in my outer life right now, and then it's like, this ghost-like figure, you know, and she's common, and is this what my psyche thinks of my situation with Tony? I don't know. I'm just going...
Yes, I think so.
And that there's...
I thought Tony seemed extraordinary to him.
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. But psyche, if this is a inner-outer thing, then the psyche sees her as common. I mean, I think that's what he's questioning. You know, this woman is my... how do you pronounce it?
Spiritrice.
And this woman is almost like a ghostly figure, and I'm supposed to save her?
Isn't this like the condition of his anima? Is this a reflection of, I mean, instead of Tony, it's a reflection of his own, the development of his anima.
Maybe.
But the moment
it's not strong and vibrant yet, he's just discovering her, and she's still looking for recognition. Just as, you know, at least the first step, recognition, and that's, it just seems like that's what that is. She may be his level of anima development, or anima development.
That's a good way to put it, maybe, then. What I get out of this is he's expecting the soul will be some grand solution. Mm-hmm. And what he's getting is a damn problem. And
people that go into analysis.
He's judging her as being common, so you think me common. She doesn't necessarily. This isn't necessarily saying she is common.
Not common.
Right. He thinks she's common.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the minute he lets her touch his heart, then he's overwhelmed by her beauty, mm-hmm. purity.
Right.
Does he say purity? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A deep purity rests in her look.
And beauty and unworldliness.
Mm-hmm. But there is beauty in the common.
Exactly. That's what he's got to learn.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And he expresses it so well at the end of that page, mm-hmm. the beauty in the commonplace. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's trying to tell him not to go too far one direction or the other. You know, he's like, oh, you're really common. Oh, you're gorgeous. And she's like, yeah, just let's go middle ground here. Because when she says, be reasonable to your friend and do not stumble now over the fabulous.
Well, that by that she means him taking her as a fairy tale figure. Isn't that what he meant by fabulous?
Mm-hmm.
Fairy tale?
Mm-hmm.
Not the idea of fabulous, but
I think that it's very not common. That now all of a sudden she's very
uncommon. The fabulous is the common, because he links it to the fairy tale, which is the great mother of the novel, and
no, she does.
The universally valid.
But she's saying that.
Right. Well, she...
I mean, I know she's he, but...
Yes, exactly.
Bottom line is, he's got this very important experience coming to him, which he minimizes, I think, at first. He expected, I don't know what he expected, something transcendental, and he gets a flesh and blood problematic relationship. That's what I understood by that. And what he's gone to see is you got to accept that, and it will then become the golden experience that you were thinking it was. It is what you thought it was, you just don't know it.
That would be the switch from Christianity that saw the Virgin or the God.
Yeah.
And, you know, the psychology that's more down to earth, but then over time you find that it does give you all the things that the religious thought.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said. Exactly.
And then she asked the same question that Salome asked.
Where's
that
again?
On 263, do you love me? Mm-hmm. Now, Salome asked him the same question. Don't you remember?
No. No, I take your word for it.
Mm-hmm.
She did, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then she sends greetings from Salome.
Right, right. Where is the, what is she asking about?
On 263, where she speaks the second time.
Oh, yes, yes.
In the right column.
Yeah. Yeah, and see, apropos his expectation, I hoped he would invite me to a scholarly conversation. See, he's stuck in his head.
Where's that?
263, first column, 1, 2, fourth line. So, I mean, if you just look at this in the most, even in the most abstract way, his mind is undergoing a process of change from being dry and scholarly to the kind of mind that can work with the psyche. And he was, you know, tempted to have a scholarly mind, which cannot work symbolically. The scholarly mind thinks about subjects where the analytic mind thinks with images. It's a completely different mind.
What Jane said is really resonating with me as far as I think he comes close to calling her his ghostly lover. And yet again, if he expected something more than common because of his scholarly
elevation, yeah.
Yeah. And he gets the dime novel version, that ego, he would be very happy about that. And I wonder if that goes into that. And that the reason she appears to him that way is because he needs to get out of that tower.
Absolutely.
And the way he sees her, the way he sees her is like where his development, his femininity, development of his feminine is. Like you said, I wouldn't say that's untrue, right? Because he has been this very powerful man. He's done all the right things. He's gotten his, you know, doctorate. He's worked with all these people. He's fathered all these children, and he's a pretty good guy, scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an image that he doesn't. That ego would not feel he deserved.
Mm-hmm. I agree totally. And then as you come to grips with that, maybe we'll stop at this one, we'll pick up with it next time. If no outer adventure happens to you, then no inner adventure happens to you either.
Right.
So after all is said and done, he's got another adventure. He was hoping it would be roses and it's daisies. But by God, I'm on this inner journey, and I thought I could this keep it mental. Ha ha.
Where was that? That was a good one.
263. The after the break, we're at number 2.
Okay.
In a way, I think you know, we get so much stuff. It's helped every once in a while to reach a piece of solid land. And I think that sentence is one of them. This is what's been going on. Doesn't like it necessarily, but he's committed to the inner journey. Oops, it's making outer demands. Might be a place to stop.
Might be.
It is a place to stop. Yeah. So let me see. I had you read to 265.
Mm-hmm.
We may not get farther than that next time, but in case we do, why don't you read to 267? To right before the anchorite.
Do you remember in Aquarius? Story where he has to eat the red rose,
mm-hmm.
and here she turns into this shadowy profusion of red roses. And in that story, what is the name of that story, Gary? I can't remember.
Sorry?
What's the name of the story?
The Golden Ass of Apuleius.
Right. He almost comes close to roses at one point, but it's the roses that then bring him back to his humanness, right? So here we have that laying in the shadow after she dissolves into the darkness.
There are certain parallels. I think Apuleius' story is a little different. First he becomes an ass, and then he has to eat the roses.
Okay.
It's more the psychology of a prig.
Okay.
Who is... I mean, you can see parallels, but... who would be above it all? Well, you certainly see some of that here. But you also see a guy who is... he's tasted life. Where I think Apuleius is the psychology story, the psychology of a guy who hasn't tasted life. A mama's boy who's just ethereal and effete. And first he's got to become a pig, and then he's got to become human. It happens to be my story. So... yeah, I told you that story in divinity school of a dream in divinity school where I was climbing up a ladder, up, and then I realized I'd come to the end and I fell and the devil caught me. So that devil was becoming an ass. I had to live that out to get rid of the mother injunction and then had to make that human. I say there are certain parallels, but Jung is much more differentiated
right.
than that.
But I just wondered about the image of roses and eros and
he is
and heart and
I think he's already accepted that with Emma.
Okay.
But he's just getting hit again because there's more work to do. This is not a function of his being particularly one way or the other, but of what is being asked of him in the future.
So you said that could we look at this whole journey as an attempt by the psyche to change his mind to a symbolic mind?
To change his mind to a symbolic mind, to understand how life and growth work together, how passion and growth work together, passion and creativity work together,
mm-hmm.
passion and meaning. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know. Go babysit for 1 year
old. Oh, okay. We will stop. Thank you. Have a good Christmas, and we'll see you back January 6th.